Today I wanted us to turn to the book of Revelation. Wanted to do a study on one of the chapters here in the book of Revelation. I know that's kind of probably a scary thing to do. There's a lot of controversy around the book of Revelation. There's a lot of interpretations and people have all kinds of ideas and those kind of things about the proper hermeneutic to take of the book. But I don't know, the more I've studied the book several times, I've taken it several times on the undergraduate level, I've taken it on the graduate level as well and read through the book several times. I think if we just take the book in a chronological fashion, it just kind of naturally unfolds and kind of makes more sense. I also believe if you kind of keep the distinctions between Israel and the church maintained throughout the book, I think you'll also kind of understand the book a little bit more. But you got to step back from the book of Revelation. You have to understand that there are probably some things in this book that really we just don't fully understand. And a lot of people have a problem with that. They really struggle with that because in our manly, fleshly mindset, we think we've got to understand everything. We've got to have our little, you know, distinctive, well, this is my little private pet interpretation of this, and I've got to seemingly gloat about all this, and, you know, so I kind of maybe some twist things or put them out of context or think I can try to understand some things when, you know, there are some things that God may not want us to understand. And that's tough for people to deal with because it's kind of like our pride gets in there. But there are some things that God may be only partially revealed. In the final analysis, we may think we know what God's going to do, and then He may do something totally different than what we think He's going to do. So we kind of have to be open-minded with this book a little bit, not be totally dogmatic with some things, but there are a lot of things that are clear, they're cut, but you know, with other things, kind of have to be a little trust in the Lord in those. Lord, I don't know exactly what you're going to do here, but you're giving some indications and we're going to trust you. But many can't handle like the lack of information, so to speak, in the book. So they kind of read stuff into the passages, make things fit together. And there are some things that we're going to look at this morning that you know, are clearly shown in the chapter or in the rest of the book. And there's other things that, you know, necessarily we may not exactly know what direction God's going to go in. But before we get into chapter 12 of Revelation, I want to note that chapter 12 is kind of like a parenthetical chapter. There are a couple chapters in the book of Revelations that are kind of a revelation. Why did I say revelations? I've been listening to my high schoolers too much. They always say that, revelations, you know, revelation. And there are a couple chapters in that book, in this book, that are parenthetical. It's almost as if John said, all right, let's stop for a second here. And let's kind of catch up with what's going on. You know, I know my wife gets upset at me because sometimes, I know, like the other night I came in late and she was watching some old movie that she had seen years ago. And I sat down and was like, all right, what's going on here? You know, what do I want to get? I want to get the recap and I want to know the whole story in 30 seconds so I don't have to sit there and watch it and I can go on to bed. Y'all know what I'm talking about, guys? Yeah. You know what I'm talking about? Well, you know, that's kind of what my wife gets mad. You know, I don't want to, you just sit here and watch it. Be quiet. Well, I can't. So, you know, I got to know everything. But that's kind of what John's doing here. He's like, let's stop for a second. Let's kind of recap what's going on. Chapter 7 with the 144,000. That's one of those parenthetical chapters that's crucial to the book. But here in this chapter, without understanding chapter 12, you can't understand the rest of the book. And I've kind of struggled with this, what to title this thing. I can call it, there's four actors in chapter 12. They're in two different groups and just different things like that that we're going to see. But there are four main actors in chapter 12 that we're going to study that are going to help us understand the direction of the rest of the book. And if we get these things out of whack, we may kind of not understand what the Lord is wanting to do. But here what's going to happen is the book of Revelation is beginning to kind of wind things down to what? The final battle, the final judgments. Those kind of the end of time where God is going to consume all things. And it's almost as if John wants to stop here so we can all be reminded, why are we in this situation? Why is the world in this tribulation? Why is this Antichrist coming? Why is Israel being so persecuted? Why are all these things happening? And he wants us to understand them. So I hope as we go through this chapter, we'll understand some of these things. Now, John wants us to remember one main thing as we kind of look over this chapter. And sometimes we need to understand this and kind of stop. You know, sometimes we just go on our Christian life and or just kind of walk along. And sometimes we just don't think necessarily about what's going on. The big picture of what is happening here. We've got to understand something. There is a long-standing conflict between God and Satan. Now, how many times do we forget that? We forget it a lot. I mean, how many times do I wake up in the morning and say, all right, Lord, there's a long-standing conflict between you and Satan? We don't think about it a lot. But I tell you, it needs to be in the forefront of our minds. There is a struggle, there is a conflict here. In the beginning of this conflict, Satan desired to what? Exalt himself above the Creator. That's where it all started. He wanted to exalt himself above God, so God cast him out of heaven, and he's still convinced that he can defeat God. He believes it with his whole heart, his whole mind. He believes he can defeat God, and he's currently working as the what? The prince and power of this air. Because he believes that he can stop everything that pertains to godliness. That's what he's out to do. Anything that has to do with God and godliness, he wants to stop it. Now, in the tribulation period, he has worked to bring the world together. That's what he's doing. He's doing it now. Have you noticed? I mean, he's bringing the world together. The religion is kind of condensing down. Governments are condensing down. And what does he want to do? Set himself up as the world ruler, because he believes in that position, he can what? Defeat God. Now, that's in his mind. That's what he believes he can do. And he believes he can take the universe away from God and be the sole authority and ruler of this universe. So you can see that we're heading to a finality. We're already heading to a culmination of a war type thing, which is revealed in Revelation chapter 19, when Christ returns, the second advent of his second coming. But the unfolding of events leading up to that is chapters 13 through 19. What happens to lead to that final battle is given in those chapters. And then chapter 12, which we're going to look at this morning, kind of sets the stage for the events of 13, 14, 15, and so on to that final battle of chapter 19. Now, ever since, as I said, his fall, Satan is very important to understand. And I tell you, we forget it as Christians. He has worked against anything representative of God on this earth. If it represents God, he's going to go after it. He's going to be against it. You think about the Old Testament. How did God work? What nation did God work through in the Old Testament? Israel. So what did Satan do? Did he go after Israel? Oh, you better believe it. I mean, we could read the entire Old Testament, and that is pretty much the story of how Satan was working against Israel. Now, you know, we can't blame Satan for everything, because man did what he wanted to do as well. But it's kind of like he knew. He's been acting. He was working. He was drawing them to idolatry. All those things that he did, he raised up different nations and people and leaders, and he was working in his sinfulness of different other men, mankind, to draw Israel away from God. He did not like the fact that this nation represents and is God is working through them. I've got to stop it. In the Old Testament, what did God send? I mean, in the New Testament, he sent the Messiah. He sent the Messiah through Israel, and the nation was deceived, weren't they? They were in religious blindness, and what did they do to the Messiah? They crucified him. They killed him. So God set Israel aside, and is now, as is in the book of Acts, we see, he's working in the gospel to the Gentiles, to give it to the entire world in the church age. So now what do you think Satan's working against? The church. He's out to get you. He's out to stop the believers that are trying to fulfill this work of God, his kingdom, his universe. So now, you know, you can think of all the things that are going against the church right now. You know, the persecution, the suffering, all the governmental influences against the church, how he's raising up unbelievers and wicked men that try to condemn and stop the church or stop Christianity or stop the ability of you to believe. That's one of the things that's really stood out to me in this study I've been doing on new atheism. They do not want you to believe anything. How dare you believe? You know, it was interesting. I pointed this out one time, but Sam Harris wrote that the solution will be a world government. The solution to the problem of religion, this was written in 2007, is going to be a world government. Now, you see, what did I say? Satan's working. He's going to use these men. He's going to use these movements. He's going to use these governments. He's going to try to bring about his program. But I want you to understand something. Satan's doing all this, and he thinks he's got it down. But who? God is still in control, even over Satan. But we forget that, don't we? And God's just letting him do what he thinks he's going to do to win, get the victory. Just go ahead. And God's going to come in the end, and he's going to do his will. We know that. So kind of keep that in mind as well. But in the future, you know what's going to happen. The church is going to be raptured off the earth. Christ is going to return for us. And God is going to bring Israel back onto the scene to finish his program for them. Why? Because God promised it. And he will fulfill his promises. So what's going to happen when God turns back to Israel? What's Satan going to turn to? Remember, he works against everything that represents God on this earth. The Old Testament Israel, he worked against them. Us now, when Messiah came, he tried to work against it. The church, he's working against the church. When God goes back to Israel, what's Satan going to work against? Again, Israel. And this is what we're going to begin to see here in Revelation chapter 12. I wanted to read a quote real quick that there's a really good commentator from Great Britain. His name is John Phillips, and he wrote the following. He said, "God's glorious plans have been revealed, and now Satan's schemes are unmasked. We are shown what he has been after since the dawn of time. His plans for this planet include the eradication. This is what Satan's plans are. Eradicate all who in any way remind him that God has a purpose on earth. The unification of the world under a single head and the adoration of the entire human race. That's what Satan wants. That's what he's after. So these chapters, chapters 12 and 13, review what has been left unsaid in previous descriptions of Revelation. They tell us how the great tribulation is brought about, how the great tyrant is brought in. Satan's ruling passion is the theme of chapter 12, and his regent prince, the Antichrist, is the theme of chapter 13. And that's what John Phillips wrote about that. So chapters 12 and 13 are keys here to the continuation of the book. Now, chapter 12 is only 17 verses, and I wanted to quickly read through it. I don't want to get laborious with this and, you know, reading through. I know sometimes people get like this when you start reading through passages of Scripture, but stay with me. You guys know I talk fast, so maybe I can keep you awake. Chapter 12, verse number 1. There appeared a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. She, being with child, cried, travailing in birth, and pained to be delivered. And there appeared another wonder in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns upon his heads. And his tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven, and it cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman, which was ready to be delivered, for to devour her child as soon as it was born. And she brought forth a man-child, who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron, and her child was caught up unto God and to his throne. And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she hath a place prepared of God, that they should feed her there 1,260 days. And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon. The dragon fought and his angels, and prevailed not, neither was their place found any more in heaven. And the great dragon was cast out. That old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world, he was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. And I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, Now is come salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ. For the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accused them before our God day and night. And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. And they loved not their lives unto the death. Therefore rejoice, ye heavens, and ye that dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and of the sea, for the devil is come down upon you, having great wrath, because he knoweth that he hath but a short time. Key little phrase there. And when the dragon saw that he was cast into the earth, he persecuted the woman which brought forth the man-child. And to the woman were given 2 wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness, into her place where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the face of the serpent. And the serpent cast out of his mouth water as a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away of the flood. And the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened her mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon cast out of his mouth. And the dragon was wroth with the woman and went to make war with the remnant of her seed, which keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. Now, we've read that chapter kind of quickly, but you notice 4 main actors there. 4 main characters. Anybody want to take a guess at who some of them are? Okay, well, just take what the verse says first. What characters are there? A woman. What else is it? What does the woman have? A man-child. Then who else is there in verse number 3? There's a great red dragon. And what else is there? There are the stars that he drew out of heaven. There's 4 main actors. Notice there's 2 groups. There's the woman and the man-child, and there's the great red dragon and the stars that he drew. Now let's discuss some of these things here. These 4 main actors that lead us to the end of what's going to happen at the end time here. First of all, let's notice, I want to quickly look at each one of these. First of all, the woman. Look in verse 1. There are 3 descriptions given about this woman, and I'm going to briefly go over them. Then when we start talking about the man-child, hopefully it'll make a little more sense. First, the woman, it says, is clothed with the sun. Now this word clothed in the Greek is a perfect, we're going to do some English, you know, tenses and stuff. Maybe Ariane can help us out back there. It's a perfect passive participle, and it means to clothe around or to cast garments on. Now, it's in the passive tense. Does that mean the woman took the clothing and put them on herself? Is that what that means? No. Passive means what? Somebody else cast these garments. Somebody else clothed around this woman with the sun. It was done by another at a specific time in the past. This covering continues to the present. That's the perfect tense. It happened in the past, and that covering of the sun continues to the present. So, in the past, someone cast the clothing of the sun around this woman, and it continues to now. Now, just physically speaking, what does the sun do? It's a source of light, right? And when it's applied to the woman here, she was given or clothed with the ability to send out light. It's also a source of warmth and blessing and life. So as the metaphor continues, the woman, whoever she is, was given the ability to grant blessing, to grant life, to grant light to those that are around her. She was given that blessing. Now, secondly, in verse number 1, she had the moon under her feet. This word in the Greek, it's an adverb that indicates they were beneath her feet, and it's in the sense of dominion or subjection. Like, you know, they say, have all things under her feet. You know, remember the Old Testament times, they would, kill the king or whatever. They'd stand, they put your foot on top of his neck or whatever, and, you know, you've broken his will. He's under your feet. Or I've read in the history books of some historians that say they would pile up the heads of the kings and things like that and ride over them as they go into the city to show, hey, we triumphed over them. They're under our feet, the dominion that we have. So it's a sign of dominion. This woman then has dominion. Thirdly, she has a crown of 12 stars. Now, this crown, Stephanos in the Greek, is a reward that was given at public games. You know, running for the Olympics or whatever they had back then and doing all those things. And they would give them this garland wreath type thing that they wore. It's also used, though, to indicate royalty. Stephanos is also used to indicate royalty. So this crown indicates a special position of exaltation that was given to this woman. It has 12 stars, and which means that this special recognition is given in 12 different ways, and we'll look at that in a few minutes. Now, to understand the full meaning of these three characteristics, I want us to look at the second main character, the man-child. Look in verse number 2. The woman travailed and birthed a man-child, and this birth is described in verse number 5. Skip down to verse number 5. Notice carefully the descriptions here. He was to rule all nations with a rod of iron. That's point number 1. 2, he was caught up to God and to his throne. So he will rule all nations, he was caught up to God, and he has a throne. Three characteristics of this man-child. Now let's look at these quickly. The phrase, to rule all nations with a rod of iron, this is used again in Revelation 19. If you just flip over there, if you don't, just listen. This is talking about Jesus Christ when he returns. Out of his mouth goeth a sharp sword, that with it he should smite the nations and rule them with a rod of iron. As John describes Christ in his victory over the nations here, it's also prophesied in Psalm chapter 2, verse 9. We won't go back and look at that. But this man-child who rules and has a throne, it's a position eternally of exaltation. And the only person who fits this description is who? It's Jesus Christ. It's given us in chapter 19. It's also prophesied in Psalm chapter 2. It is Jesus Christ. This man-child then is the Lord Jesus Christ. Now, if you look over in verse number 5, I want you to notice something quickly there. It says, first of all, who was to rule, and then later it says, was caught. Now, that little word was, we just read verbs and we just go right over them like it's nothing. But this little word in the Greek, it actually has two different tenses. Two different tenses here. The first time it's given here, who was to rule all nations, is the present tense, and it indicates he's at the point of commencing something. In other words, this man-child is at the point of beginning to rule the nations. He's ready to do it. He's ready to come down and commence that. Now, secondly, when it says it was caught up into God, that is the aorist tense, which means it happened in the past. So I hope you see that is talking about Jesus Christ, that in the past he was caught up to God, but now he is standing, he is ready to commence, he's ready to begin his rule of the nations. So this man-child was caught up in the past, he's on the verge of commencing a new action, and that action is described as ruling, or in the Greek, governing. And in, you know, we can look at the later chapters of Revelation, chapters 19 and 20. We see Christ returning in Armageddon. We see him fighting. We see him setting up his rule, the millennial kingdom, and reigning and governing a forced rule over the nations. Now let's kind of go back and look at this first group. The man-child, who we know is Jesus Christ, who is now ready to commence a new thing. He's ready to come down and rule. But this man-child and the woman together, since the woman birthed Jesus Christ, this must be the nation of Israel. Now, this cannot be an individual person because the woman is described as continuing after the ascension of Christ on into the tribulation period. So that longevity like that indicates that this must be a nation of some sort. So when the three descriptions of the woman are applied to Israel who birthed Jesus Christ in the human sense, more sense is kind of made out of the role of this woman here. Let's notice, first of all, she was clothed with the sun. Remember that? She was clothed with the sun. God chose, He endowed Israel as a special nation with the purpose of being a light and being a blessing to all the earth. Even, you know, you go back to the Abrahamic covenants, you go back to the call of Abraham, chapters 12 and 15 of Genesis. God promised what? To bless Abraham to the point that Abraham would what? Bless all the families of the earth. That is the promise that was given to Israel. Now remember, we said this was a perfect passive participle. It wasn't that Israel went out and was able to obtain this blessing on their own. It was God chose them. God endowed them. God gave them this ability to be a blessing to the other nations. Keep your finger there in Revelation chapter 12 and flip over to Acts chapter 13 real quick this morning. Acts chapter 13. Here's what God did for Israel. Verse 47. For so hath the Lord commanded us, saying, chapter 13, verse 47, I have set thee to be a light of the Gentiles, that thou shouldest be for salvation unto the ends of the earth. That's what Israel, that's what God did. He endowed them. He called them. He clothed them with this light, this ability to show forth to the Gentiles. So out of that, through Jesus Christ, this blessing would ultimately come. Now, the moon that's under her feet, secondly, back in Revelation chapter 12, this is the dominion that is given to Israel. God chose Israel to be a great nation. And when is this dominion going to be ultimately fulfilled? In the millennial time, the millennial kingdom. In the millennium, when Christ is ruling on earth from Jerusalem, the dominion that nation will have, and the dominion of Christ will be centered around Israel, and God will clothe them with this dominion. And then thirdly, just quickly, the crown of 12 stars would indicate, of course, possibly, we don't know for sure, but you know, these are kind of, some of these things we say, you know, we believe that it could possibly be that. But the crown of 12 stars could be the 12 tribes, perhaps. You know, we aren't told exactly what they are, what it is, but it could be the 12 tribes and their role in the history of Israel and how God worked through those 12 tribes throughout history. So this is the first group, the woman Israel and the man-child, the Messiah, who comes through the nation of Israel to rule the world. This is, now let's stop and think, this is the program of God. This is the first group. This is what God wants. He wants the rule of His Son. He's given that to His Son. But as we've already pointed out, what is Satan trying to do? He wants to stop that rule. We're going to stop the rule of the Son. He wants to be in control of the universe. And he still believes, as I said, that he can take this man-child out. He can prevent this kingdom that Messiah is going to have. So in verses 3 through 4, we're introduced to the next group and the two actors that are in this group that are trying to stop. They don't want this Messiah to have his rule. They don't want God's program. Anything that represents God, they want it annihilated. They want it stopped, eradicated. Let's notice, first of all, in verse number 3, another great wonder. This is semion in the Greek. It describes a symbol. Semion means it's a symbol that points to a reality. So yes, the red dragon is a symbol, but behind that is a reality. That's the meaning of the Greek word. He's a symbol of something else, just like the woman and the man-child are. This dragon is described as red, or, you know, it's interesting in the Greek, that word means kind of fiery. You know, you think about Satan, you think about the dragon, you think about, you know, there's nothing peaceable and nice about a fiery creature. I don't know, I wouldn't want to be confronted with one of those. It's fearful, it's dreadful, is the point that's coming across here. That's the description. He has 10 horns, he has 7 heads, each of them with a crown, all these little details that are given. And, you know, the meaning of these heads and horns, we may come to that in a few minutes, but what is this dragon? You ever heard of the phrase, let the Bible interpret itself? Well, go down to verse 9. We're told just point blank what it is. And the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil. Okay, the Bible goes ahead and tells us who the red dragon is. It is the devil, which deceiveth the whole world. It's symbolic of Lucifer, symbolic of Satan, who fell from heaven, who rules the air, who has been for centuries deceiving in an endeavor to thwart God's work, in an endeavor to stop the program of God. And, you know, at this point in history, when we get down to the end time, he's getting pretty nervous, because has he been able to stop the program of God up to this point? No. And he's like, boy, I better pull something together here real quick, and I better be very aggressive, because I've got to stop this nation. I've got to stop this Messiah that's coming. Now, let's look at the deception of the nations. We just saw the description of the dragon. Let's look at the deception of the nations. This dragon wants to deceive the nations. It talks about the heads, the crowns, the horns of the dragon that are symbols of the earthly power that Satan claims. These have been interpreted, I mean, there's a lot of interpretations. I don't know that we can definitely say which one, but some have said these are the seven stages of the Roman Empire. Some have said they're the seven main world empires, Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greco-Macedonia, Rome, and then the Antichrist government. There's a lot of different things here. But if you go over just quickly to Revelation chapter 17, these horns and heads and things, crowns and all that, come up again. So the seven heads and horns and all these things from verse number 3. The seven heads could be the nations of the world. We aren't exactly sure about that. But go to chapter 17 because we are told something else about these things. Chapter 17, verse 12. The 10 horns which thou sawest are 10 kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. These have one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. There's going to be 10 horns, 10 kings. I don't know if that means that there's going to be 10 nations left at the time of Antichrist. I don't know. It could be. It could be that the world is condensing down to what? This one government. You think about the many, many hundreds of nations that are in our world today. But yet you hear the calls for unification. You know, you think, I mean, you could talk about all kinds of things. Europe condensing down to a common market and the euro and all those kind of things. And just the call for, let's just all get together. And I believe that as the worse the economy of the world gets, it's going to be, people will want to do what? Unify in a greater way, right? We can support each other. We can help each other and all these kind of things. And all the things are going to come together. And I don't know, it may be that, you know, we don't know for sure, but it may be that all these nations are going to condense down to 10 nations. And when Antichrist comes, what are these 10 kings going to do? They're probably going to be scared out of their minds of this great, powerful leader. And they're going to, it says there in chapter 17, what did it say in verse number 13? They shall give their power and strength to the beast. What are they going to do? They're going to give their kingdoms. We give you our power. Let's all unify together under Antichrist. Now, is Satan sitting back going, yes, this is working out great. Now I've got all the nations of the world as one, and we're going to go against one puny little tiny nation, Israel, and we're going to stop God's program. Yeah, we got him now. That's what Satan is aiming for. That's why he wants one whole world, the entire world, turn against God's nation. Boy, you see it today, don't you? You see the little start of it. I tell you, our pastors talked about it too, but I tell you, I was disappointed when Obama and you start going against Israel, start making little statements that are against Israel. We're in trouble. We're in trouble. I'm telling you, I really believe one of the reasons why God has protected this country for several years and things is because we've always supported Israel. So to be honest with you, what are you doing if you go against Israel? You're helping the plan of who? Satan. That's what he wants. The world against them. Because through them is Jesus Christ. And we've got to stop him. We've got to thwart him. We can't have this. And I tell you, these things are beginning to come together. These kings that will give over their rulers. And regardless of the details of all the interpretations here, the fact remains that Satan is active in the governments of the world today. He wants to gain power in governments. He wants to use human government to manipulate humanity so that he can stop the plan of God. And this is all going to reach its climax in the tribulation period. Now, we've seen the description of the dragon. We've seen the deception of the nations by the dragon. Let's look thirdly at the dissimulation of some angels. This is the other actor, verse number 4. With his tail, he drew the third part of the stars of heaven and cast them down to the earth. Now, you know, a lot of conjecture here, but you know, most people believe that this is referring to the fall of Lucifer when he took one third of the angels with him with his tail and all those kind of things. But I wanted to notice something real quick about this. In the Greek, it's to literally draw, it's literally to drag them. So you kind of see an indication of a persuasive force. Some kind of force is dragging. It's almost like if you took some type of thing in a boat and like pulled a bunch of water and then stopped, that tidal wave would continue, wouldn't it? You know, and you'd have a little bit of force that just carries you. That's kind of the idea here. But this awful tale of power refers to maybe perhaps the instrument of lying power. Go to Isaiah chapter 9. Verse 15. Just real quick, keep your finger in Revelation. Isaiah chapter 9. This is referred to in the Bible before. Now, it's not really talking about the devil, but it's talking about the tail. The tail was used as this before in the Bible. So perhaps this is what God is trying to say. Now, we can't be, you know, dogmatic on it, but look at chapter 9, verse 15. or verse 14. Therefore, the Lord, now it's talking about the lying prophets in chapter 9 here. It's talking about those prophets that are deceitful. Verse 14. The Lord will cut off from Israel head and tail, branch and rush in one day. The ancient and the honorable, he is the head. The prophet that teacheth lies, he is the tail. So could it be, now we don't know for sure, but I'm just saying, could it be that as Lucifer fell and was removed from heaven, his deception, his lies, caused one-third of the host to be what? Convinced that Lucifer can actually do this. It's almost like if you walk into a pickup game of a baseball or something, and you get to pick which team you want to be on. You know, this team has 40 runs, this one has 2, kind of like our July 4th picnics. Chris and I's team have -5, and the rest of them have 40. But, you know, what do you do? I'm going to go with the team that I think can win the most. And with his lying tail, hey, come over to my team, so to speak. I'm going to get it. I'm going to have the whole world turned against Israel. Boy, that devil was a liar, isn't he? Think about Eve. From the beginning, he's a liar. Don't worry about what God said. God doesn't know what he's talking about. I got this. You're not going to die. Don't you worry about it one bit. Lying and deceiving and convinced a third, they were pulled along, dragged with the persuasive power of his deception. They were dragged down to fall with him, convinced that they are going to have the victory. Convinced. So now in chapter 12, you know, you could think about the angels that have fallen, that are now working. You know, you see them at the time of Christ, all the things, the encounters that Christ had with them. But throughout history, the demons have aided to what? They've aided the attempt of overthrowing the righteous, of overthrowing the godly, of stopping everything that has to do with God. So even in the book of Revelation, we read stories about hordes of demons that are unleashed. What are they doing? They're trying to help Satan. We're going to get this thing down. We're going to destroy Israel. We're going to destroy the man-child. So in our context of chapter 12, the dragon and the fallen stars are working together against what? The woman and the man-child. These two opposing sides and these four actors. Now, how will these two interact? I know our time is quickly going here, but it will be in the form of attacks by the dragon upon the woman. Satan attacking Israel. Now think for a moment. The dragon is going to go after Israel, the woman, because the man-child was what? In verse number 5, he was caught up to the throne. So can he go after the man-child? No. So who can he go after? The next best thing. I can stop the woman. I can stop Israel. I can defeat this nation. And that's the plan that Satan has in the form here. He knows that the man-child is going to return to do what? Satan knows this. He's not dumb. He reads prophecy. He probably knows the Bible better than we do. He knows that Christ is going to come back and he's going to rule this nation. So if I destroy the nation, then what? Christ has nothing to come back to rule with. Pretty nifty little plan he thinks he's got going on here. And he's going to try to execute it. So as we wind down our message this morning, I want us to see the three attacks of the dragon that he makes. He makes three attacks on the nation. First, in verse number 4, he attacks the man-child. Now, this is before the man-child is caught up to heaven. Look at verse number 4. With his tail, he drew the third part of the stars of heaven. Go to the end of the verse. Dragon stood before the woman, ready to be delivered, to devour her child as soon as it was born. This verb stood means he's standing by. And it's in the perfect tense, which means he got in position and he continued to stand. And he did not leave that position until he thought he had the opportunity. In other words, it's a picture of what? Anticipation. Oh, I'm going to get that man-child. I'm going to devour him. I'm going to stop this plan of God. He knew that this was the Son of God coming in the flesh. He said, oh, this is my chance. This is my big chance. I've got to stop this event. I've got to stop the incarnation. I've got to stop Christ going to Calvary. Because then what does that do? That helps the plan of God. And I want to stop the plan of God is what Satan is saying. So he's out to stop this event at all cost. So he's ready to totally eat up, totally consume the man-child. The Greek word here for devour is in the it's kind of a unique mood in the Greek. It's called subjunctive. And it means there's a great potential. So the devouring, he sees a massive potential, an opportunity to devour the man-child as soon as what? He's delivered. And he's waiting, and he's ready. Boy, you see at the time of Christ's birth, the endeavor to destroy the God-man. He kept a close eye on him, the time and place of his birth. You know, throughout the history of the Jews, specifically during the time of Christ's birth, Satan has endeavored to what? Cut off the seed that's going to do what? Bruise his head. He knows what God said in Genesis chapter 3:15. He knows it, and he's going to stop it. One commentator noted the murder of Abel, trying to stop the seed. Pollution of humanity in Genesis 6. The bondage of Israel in Egypt, and trying to kill the man child. The decree of Haman. Herod's decree in Matthew chapter 2 to kill the babies. That's right at the time of Christ's birth. The storm on the Sea of Galilee. You ever thought about that one? You ever thought about that storm on the Sea of Galilee? You know, a lot of times we preach that message and we think, God was trying to teach the disciples to have faith. You ever thought about this? Satan wanted the storm to kill the man child. Could have been. But he didn't realize something. God has control over the storm and over the wind. What about the many attempts of the Jews to kill Christ? But what the Bible always says, his time was not yet come. God's in control of the time. So the dragon knew the incarnation was what? A pathway for humanity to come to God. And what would that do? It would completely unravel the deception in the Garden of Eden and everything else Satan has been working on. It's like he felt like he took 5 steps forward and 400 back. That's what Satan's going to feel like when the incarnation comes true, when Christ pays the price for our sins. Now, just quickly, our time is going, but between verses 5 and 6, it's just we see he's caught up to God. He's now with God. And then it goes immediately to the woman fleeing for 1260 days, the last half of Daniel's last week. Now, between 5 and 6, a lot of people believe, we can't say for sure, but a lot of people believe that's the church age, so to speak. Here, he's caught up into heaven, and then suddenly we go to the end time with Israel. Well, that unspoken section there could possibly be the church age. And now we're at the fleeing and the hiding of Israel. So there is a second attack. The first attack was on the man-child. A second attack is on the existence of the woman. As I said, since Christ is in heaven, he's going to attack the nation so it won't exist for the millennium. But what does God do? I tell you, we're going to notice this. I hope we have time to close with this. He intervenes and he hides and he protects the people that he's chosen. Now, why do the people have to hide? Real quick, we're not going to look at it heavy, but verse 7 through probably down to verse 13. Why does Israel have to hide? It's because Satan has been cast out of the air. There's a war with Michael. He's defeated. Now, he doesn't get cast out of heaven like where God is, but the prince of the power of the air. Now, I'm going to tell you, you think it's bad now for Satan to be in the air? What about if he's cast down and restricted to the earth? What's he going to do while he's down here? He's going to look for Israel. He's going to destroy them. He wants to defeat them. So Israel has to hide. They have to be protected. That's why. God's going to work. There's 3 attacks against Israel, and God's going to work to protect them. Just quickly. First of all, it says in verse 13, that the dragon saw that he was cast to the earth. He persecuted the woman, which brought forth the man-child. He pursues the woman. That's the word in the Greek there. Persecute is dioko, which means to pursue. And it's in the active aorist. He's actively pursuing her as part of his agenda. I've got to stop this woman. And, the defeat and destruction is on the forefront of his mind. But notice again, quickly, in verse 14, God gives what? Protection. Wings as eagles, and they fly away, and so to speak. Some commentators see the wings as symbols of strength and speed and protection that God gives, perhaps as the metaphor of a hen gathering her chicks or something like that. But in other words, whatever the case is, God is going to do what? Protect them, because he's fleeing. He's pursuing them actively. Secondly, the dragon's going to attempt to overtake her in her hiding place. So here she is. She's hid. Go to verse 15. The serpent cast out of his mouth water as a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away of the flood. I can't get to her where she's hiding. I can send something out maybe and get her in her hiding place. There are several interpretations here. Some see that it's actual bodies of water that overtake the desert. Some say it's false teaching that overtake her. Some say that it's actual armies. Now, I kind of lean to that. Again, can't be dogmatic about this stuff, but I kind of lean to that. That perhaps Satan's going to send out his armies. I'm going to get them. I'm going to defeat them. And notice, again, we're going to notice something here. Here they come. Here come the armies, or whatever it is that's ready to destroy them. And verse 16, the earth helped the woman. Well, who's in control of the earth? The Creator. And the earth opened her mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon cast out of his mouth. So if this was armies, I don't know what it was. Maybe it's probably like Korah. Just open up the earth. There they go. God's going to protect his people. Verse 16 here again indicates that the earth aided her, swallowing this flood, swallowing perhaps the armies or whatever it is. The exact symbol is unknown, but maybe it was an earthquake like Korah. Maybe it was something like that. But God protected his people. Then thirdly, quickly, the third attack of the dragon is in verse 17. This is his last resort, all right? I can't get the man-child. So I'm going to go after the woman. And when I go after the woman, I'm first going to pursue her. Oh, that didn't work. Then I'm going to try to attack her in her hiding place. That didn't work. Thirdly, the only thing I have left to do is verse 17. The dragon was wroth with the woman and went to make war with the remnant of her seed, which keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. He's provoked to anger because of the hiding of the woman. And this is the final attack that he tries to make, the remaining seed of the woman. He resorts to making war with the remnant of the children of Israel that are trusting in Jesus Christ, verse 17 says. Isn't that interesting? Children of Israel that are doing what? Trusting Jesus Christ. Isn't that great? That's what God prophesied was going to happen. They're going to look on Him and they are pierced. And they're going to believe in Him. So as the rest of Revelation unfolds, the ultimate outcome of this carefully authored attempt, you know, it's almost like Satan is a strategic general here, thinks he just knows exactly what he's doing, but it's all going to stop by Jesus Christ Himself. Remember, he's ready to commence. He's ready to rule the nations. And He comes down, chapter 19, we see the Battle of Armageddon. He defeats this advance of Satan, who tries to come against Israel with the armies of the world against one puny nation. But the Lord is on that side. The Lord is for Israel. The Lord is there protecting His people. Now, these four characters, the interaction between them all are the setting for the final events of Revelation. The church is raptured off the earth. God returns to His program for Israel. This arouses the full forces of Satan. And after his fall from heaven, the great red dragon has attempted to thwart the work of God. He's involved right now in deceiving the church. How does he do it? 2 Corinthians chapter 14, his fake representation as an angel of what? Angel of light. He's now there right now trying to deceive. But when God returns to Israel, the red dragon's not going to hold anything back. He realizes his time is short. Did you remember that? Verse 12? Because he knoweth that he hath but a short time. It's almost like if you're playing a game that has a timer or something, you know, you go to the fair booths, arcade, or whatever, and they have those little basketball goals. I used to play those when I was a kid. And you have a time up there, and you're trying to make as many shots as you can. But when the time is 10, 9, you're going as fast as you can there to get the shots in. That's what Satan's realizing. My time's running out. I better go full force ahead, gung-ho, as they say. I'm going for it. And that's what Satan is trying to do. But I want us to remember, as we close, you know, the evil kingdom is going to be decimated. Christ is going to return. God is always faithful to His promises. He has not forgotten Israel. He hasn't thrown Israel out. Israel, as I said, will look on Him who they have pierced. That's Zechariah 12 and John 19. Many will be saved. Blessing will be brought back to God's people. Now, much of what we've studied today applies to Israel, the messianic aspect, those kind of things. But we can still gain some strength and some insight from these things as we close. If nothing else this morning, maybe you have an increased understanding of the events of Revelation and how Satan works. He's doing it now, dear people. But more importantly, I want us to understand as we close, the same God that's faithful to Israel is faithful to us. Now, think about it. Here's a God that said, here's three attacks that are coming. He stopped every one of them. That is the God that you serve. Isn't that wonderful? The nations of this world can do whatever they want. The economies can do whatever they want. The governments can go ahead and try to stop the Christian schools, stop the Bible, stop the prayer, stop everything. But I'm going to tell you something. We have a God who, when He makes promises, He delivers. He is faithful. And let the enemy come in like a flood because it's going to be stopped. That's exactly right. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing? And we're Gentiles. He doesn't even have to give us the time of day. What a merciful and faithful, loving God that we serve today. God's faithful no matter how bad things get. I tell you, we need to be encouraged and take hope in a sovereign God. He's allowing Satan to think he's getting the victory. And these events are unfolding. God's in control. I remember yesterday morning in our prayer meeting, Aunt Carolyn, I don't remember exactly how you prayed it, but you said something about, you know, things going to trouble. But our God's faithful. We have Him on our side and we're on His side, and it's wonderful, isn't it? Hold your head up high. World's just going to pieces. Everybody's leaving God and we're the only ones that are left. Boo-hoo, Elijah, go cry yourself a river. Hold your head up. And say, I serve a faithful God. And if He decides to take me off this planet tomorrow, if He decides to shut this school down tomorrow, can a faithful God do that and not rattle your cage too bad? You still going to serve Him? That's what we're called to do. Father, thank You so much that You're a faithful God. We love You. As Brother Paul said, we're Gentile. Lord, you weren't even intending this. Lord, we're humbled. We don't know what to say. But thank you so much for being a faithful God to your people, Israel, and you're faithful to the church. You're faithful to us. Lord, I pray that we would not forget that there is a plan going on. There is two sides. There's a struggle going on. And help us to not get so consumed with our daily lives that we just forget all that stuff. And we just go on like nothing's happening. Lord, give us strength. Give us courage. Give us faithfulness because you're faithful to us. And we praise you, Father. Pray that you just now bless our service, the time we have together this morning in Christ's name. Amen. Lord bless you.